In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Oh, yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Let's all talk a little movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joining us this afternoon. Hello, Al.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. How was your Monday? How was your weekend?
Good and good. Yeah, no, things are good.
Are you performing tonight, or is this an off night?
We are off tonight. We're off tonight, tomorrow, and then our cohort is back at it on Wednesday night. So we did open Flying Solo this weekend to a generally positive response. You know, it's something different, so you're never really sure how people are going to react. But the general consensus that I've gotten, at least thus far, the feedback's been very positive. Like, people are really these stories are resonating with people, and I think that's a good thing.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to watch you later on this week. You also saw a handful of movies this weekend, three of them, as a matter of fact. Where should we begin?
Well, there's one that I really want to spend some time on, so we'll lead with the other two, and then close out with the one that I'm very excited to share with the listeners. But to start, I'm going to talk about a documentary I saw called Clapboard Jungle. It's an interesting movie. It's by a filmmaker named Justin McConnell, and it's basically he documents sort of a 5-year journey through his own life as an independent filmmaker. So that's basically what the movie is. It's like we're watching this guy deal with the ups and downs of the movie business when you're operating sort of outside that sort of Hollywood machine. It was really kind of fascinating. Like, it's this, you know, you get this combination of him recording his own experiences trying to get stuff made, as well as interviews with a number of other industry folks who have indie connections. He really does a great job of sort of breaking down for the viewer just how difficult it is if you're operating outside the traditional studio system, you know, and that's juxtaposed with the fact that, you know, there are more movies being made right now than have ever been made before. You know, it's been a very explosive, almost exponential growth in content, thanks to the proliferation of streaming services and whatnot. I just take it my own example. Like, I reviewed over 150 movies last year. And, you know, there were hundreds that not only did I not see, like, I may not have even heard about them. Mm. Like, it's just, you know, it's one of those things where making a movie is hard, but getting it seen in a lot of cases is even harder. So this one starts in 2014, and it's Justin McConnell just speaking into the camera and promising this intimate and in-depth look at the journey he intends to take with his filmmaking career, like pending projects, goals going forward, that sort of thing. And then we basically follow him around over for the next 5 years, dealing with the ebb and flow of the industry, like attending festivals and meetings, working the phones, making contacts, landing deals with investors and distributors, only to have those deals fall through at the last minute. You know, he makes some savvy moves, he makes some mistakes, and it's just this really sort of wonderful sort of one man's perspective on the minefield that is the movie business. Now, he's a genre guy. He's a horror filmmaker, so he's pushing these projects over the years. And he does. I mean, he's, like, among the most successful, like, he's more successful than probably 99% of the aspiring filmmakers out there. Like, he does make some things. He makes some short films and a couple of micro-budget features, like writing scripts and assembling treatments and putting these pitches together. Thousands upon thousands of aspiring filmmakers never even get that far, and yet he's still struggling. And that's a perspective that we don't always get, especially since a lot of people, I think, are sort of arrested in that sort of mid-90s like indie explosion, like Sundance, you know, people basically just writing checks at Sundance kind of thing. I think a lot of people still think of indie film in that sort in those sorts of terms, and it's just not like that anymore. And throughout, we get a lot of interview segments with other people experienced in the indie film realm. Like, a lot of lesser-known names, people who helmed, like, sort of niche or cult films, But there are some really familiar names and faces in there, like Guillermo del Toro turns up. George Romero, the late George Romero, is featured prominently. And we get a lot of stuff from some great insight from Paul Schrader, the legendary screenwriter. You know, so it's like, it's not just like these guys all have indie, like, you know, they have their indie beginnings, but, you know, these are sort of success stories through there, you know. And it's like, it's a really interesting movie. And again, like, how universal it is, I don't know. But just in terms of watching one guy sort of try to make his dreams come true, it's kind of a fascinating watch. So yeah, Clapboard Jungle, pretty solid.
That sounds very good. How about The White Tiger?
Now, okay, so I said this before, but it really warrants repeating, especially with a movie like this. I love a good unreliable narrator. I think it's one of the most potent storytelling devices there is. When the audience understands from the get-go that there could be a degree of deception undertaken by the person who's telling you the story, it just allows for such a wonderful wide array of narrative exploration. And that's kind of what we get with The White Tiger. It's a movie, it's directed by Raman Barani. He adapted the script himself from Aravindiga's novel of the same name, won the Man Booker Prize back in 2008. I haven't read it, but everything I've heard is it's a great book. It's currently streaming on Netflix, and it's this weird blend of like coming of age story and crime movie. I kept landing on, it's like, I don't know, like a Bronx Tale by way of Scarface. Like, it's got that kind of vibe, only set in India. The basic gist, it's the year 2010. The Chinese premier is about to visit India. And in Bangalore, there's an entrepreneur by the name of Balram, played by Adarsh Gurav, who seeks an audience with the premier. And in an effort to capture the premier's attention, he starts composing a message, one that lays out his life story and how he reached sort of his current heights. And so we flash back. And so this sort of missive that he's writing basically serves as the framework of the film. So we go back to his childhood, where we see him demonstrate, you know, intelligence and aptitude for learning in his, you know, sort of ramshackle villages, tiny school. His potential so great that arrangements are made for him to attend a private school in Delhi on scholarship. But his grandmother refuses and instead makes him stay home and work at the family tea shop. The years pass, he grows up, but Balram never stops seeking an escape from this life. And finally, in 2007, he sees his chance. The landlord of the village is getting older, and his sons will soon be taking over control of everything, including the financial collections. Like, there's an older, rougher son that they all call the Mongoose, played by Vijay Murya. But Balram's got his eyes set on the younger son, a young man named Ashok, played by Rajkumar Rao. And he figures if he can become a servant to this family, he can leave the village behind. And so he tries to ingratiate himself to Ashok and the family and basically becomes Ashok's driver. Now, Ashok has just come back from years spent in America, where he, among other things, met and married his wife, who goes by Pinky. And that's Priyanka Chopra, who's very good here. Has brought back also some rather more progressive views regarding caste and the treatment of servants, such as Balram. You know, and Balram starts making inroads with Ashok and Pinky, building a relationship, again, within the sort of confines of the servant-master power dynamic. But when an unanticipated tragedy strikes, Balram learns just where he stands with everybody. And it becomes clear to him that if he's going to get what he wants, what he thinks he deserves, he's going to have to figure out a way to take it for himself. And interspersed throughout, we get glimpses of the Balram of years later, a very different guy living a very different life. And we start to see these two places, past and present, converging. So, you know, the path from one to the other becomes clearer, but there are still, you know, some surprises along the way. It's, you know, it's good. It's a really good movie. It's, the performances are phenomenal. Like I said, like, you know, the chronological shifting gives us the end before the beginning, but we get to travel the path that leads there. We basically get the sort of smug, self-important version of our guy, first of all, I sort of refer to it as this movie is kind of like the anti-hero's journey, if that makes sense. You know, so it's just it's really well made. You know, we get a juxtaposition of the wealthy domiciles and the ramshackle villages and the people living in the respective places visually. So it's, you know, you get this real sort of aesthetic sense of the caste differences that are inherent to the story. You know, basically weaponizes the landscape, you know, sort of using it as accentuation and punctuation. And those contrasts really serve to sort of accentuate the film's basic aesthetic. And again, the performances are excellent. Gurav is great. Rao is wonderful as Ashok. Priyanka Chopra is very talented, and she does a great job. They do most of the heavy lifting. Like pretty much all the performances are excellent, but those three are really the highlights. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a compelling story. The performances are great. Some unexpected twists, and again, the aforementioned unreliable narration. Like it's really a pretty solid movie.
We're talking with Alan Adams, The Main Edge, here on Downtown. I can't wait to hear about this movie because everything I've read, first of all, makes me want to see it, but makes me wish I had somehow been able to see the stage production of In and of Itself.
You know, Rich, surprises are pretty rare these days when it comes to movies. Like, so much of what we see is just relentlessly promoted, and, you know, the outreach is projected through all these algorithmic and demographic prisms. Like, and, you know, and to know anything about an upcoming offering is a lot of times that's knowing anything is you might as well know everything. But that's not always the case. And so I heard a little bit about this show In and of Itself. It's a one-man show featuring a gentleman by the name of Derek Delgadio. It first took off a couple years ago, but I heard a little, but not much. Like, basically, my understanding was it was a show that utilized stage magic, but wasn't about stage magic. And that was kind of it, really. Like, you know, I didn't know anything about the content or tone or anything like that. I just knew that Delgadio was kind of being celebrated as this sort of rapidly rising star in the world of magic. And that's kind of all I knew. So I learned, you know, Hulu was going to air a filmed version of this show. And it was a show, a film version, by the way, directed by the same person who directed the stage show, who was, of all people, Frank Oz.
Mm.
You know, so it's like, oh, okay. Like, that was something I didn't know. So I'm like, all right, I'll check this out. I'll see some card tricks. It'll be great. Rich, I had no idea. Like, this was one of the most mesmerizing and compelling shows I have ever watched. Like, ever. Like, it's 90 minutes of just incredible storytelling interspersed with these sort of these feats of illusion that I just things that I'd never like seen before. And all of it in the service of this wonderful overarching exploration of the notion of identity, this idea of self, like, who am I? Like, it's just, you know, I sometimes hear the term defies description in reference to a piece of art. Like, I think most of the time, 99 times out of 100, the phrase is there not because the thing actually can't be described, but because the person saying it can't be bothered to invest the time to come up with an accurate description. Like, it's a symptom of critical laziness, except for that one time, you know, that one time out of 100 where a description really is defied. And this is that one time. Like, I agonized over writing this review, Rich, because I had no idea how to properly do it. The only thing I knew for sure was I cannot be responsible for spoiling this experience for anyone who might watch it.
Mm.
Like, I can talk about some of the storytelling segments. Like, he leads off with this wonderful parable, this story about a man who made his fortune in this incredibly unique and dangerous way. You know, and that story is kind of the framework on which the remainder of the show rests. He also talks about his life as sort of a young magician, like, making his living in, frankly, ethically questionable ways. And he couches it in this sort of ongoing dog versus wolf metaphor. And he also has a story about growing up with a single mom who's later in life coming out led to community ostracization and some worse things. Like, these are beautiful, heartfelt stories, and they're punctuated with these moments of magic. And, okay, I am not going to tell you anything about these magical interludes, because the fact that I didn't know when they were coming or what they would be when they arrived exponentially increased their effectiveness when they hit. And Rich, they are effective. Like, there's some close-up magic, some really impressive, like, card mechanics and sleight of hand. There's an extended display of mentalism that's incredibly impressive. And there are some other things that, I even hate saying, they defy description. Like, you just have to see it for yourself. And again, it doesn't hurt that this movie lands at a time when I personally am uniquely primed for it, being currently involved in a show that's built around the same sort of autobiographical storytelling.
Mm.
Like, it lends this degree of perspective that I might not have otherwise had. Like, this, it allows for a particular understanding, I guess, with regard to just how difficult it is to lay yourself bare in this way, to sort of embrace vulnerability when we share these parts of ourselves that we've been conditioned to keep private. Like, it was a challenge for me, and I had five other people sharing the weight. Like he's doing it alone, like, engaging with his fears and his doubts and his questions for, like, 90 uninterrupted minutes. It's just, like, he's, like, I went back and forth trying to figure out what comparison I could make him to. And then the closest I came is that he's like equal parts Eric Bogosian and Ricky Jay. Like, that.
Wow.
That's where I landed, you know? Like, he's got this wonderful raconteur sort of vibe to him. He's very charismatic, you know, but very comfortable in bearing his inner workings, like, live on stage. Like, he's a gifted monologist and a magician. Like, both of those talents are incredible. And when you put them together, like, it's just, you're just swept up into this sense of radical intimacy. And he just offers it up to you. He's like, here, here, please, reap this whirlwind that I've sown.
Now, let me ask you, I know that in the stage show, when people came into the theater, there was this wall of cards that said, I am, with a descriptor at the bottom, and people had to choose one of those and keep one half, give the other half to him. Can you, without giving too much away, can you explain how those cards become a part of this show?
Okay, so I will say that... those cards do play a couple of pretty significant roles within the show. I could say that at one point he takes one of the cards and uses that to involve a single audience member specifically. And at another point, he uses them to involve a much larger swath of the audience. And I don't want to go too much farther than that.
Okay.
Just because both things are, they're just so incredibly impressive on their face. He uses them to sort of find people to include them in things that, frankly, like I haven't stopped thinking about it, because some of these moments, it's like, oh, you know, it's like sometimes when you see a magic trick, it's like, oh, you just want to figure out, like, okay, how did that person do that? And this, like, they're so impressive and so mind-blowing, but at the same time, it's all in service to this greater story that's being told. And it's like he uses those skills as a tool to advance the story that he's telling. And it's just, it's the cards play a huge part, a vital part, and they tune in a number of different ways. With regards to this idea of identity, it's one of those things where I really want to talk about it, but I can't. Like, I refuse to, because not knowing what he's going to do with these things renders it so all the more impressive when you watch it sort of play out in real time. And it's like, you know, it's impressive, and then it's more impressive. And then you're just like, you're sitting there like wondering, like, what is happening? How is what he's doing right now possible? And I'll concede right now, like, there's a stretch in this movie. There's a particular moment. And I think when you watch it, you'll have a pretty good idea of where it is. I'm sitting there watching this movie, and I'm actively weeping. Like, I'm weeping. I'm so emotionally invested in what's happening on that stage that I'm openly crying tears because I've been so affected by what he's doing and the way in which he's doing it. Like, it's just and it's the sort of thing that could have gone wrong in a million ways. Like, it's that kind of show. And again, we talked about this a little bit. We've seen a bunch of really good stage-to-screen translations over the last 6 months or so. You know, whether you're talking about the full conversion you get from stuff like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and One Night in Miami, or you're talking about the sort of elevated film production take that you know, things like Hamilton and American Utopia have done. And, you know, this very much sits in that sort of latter category. But again, they all have one thing, like all of the successful ones have one thing in common, a filmmaker with a genuine connection to the material. And I mean, this is no different because Frank Oz directed the stage production and he's also directed the film, which means that he knows exactly how to translate this this story from medium to medium in a way that probably no other person would have been capable of doing. And so you really get this intimate by design stage performance shifted, like scaled up in a way that maybe shouldn't work, but it absolutely does. Like it was just a revelatory viewing experience for me. Just unbelievable.
And unfortunately for me, it's on Hulu, which I think is, you know, one of the two out of the 99 streaming services I don't have.
Well, we'll have to figure out a way to rectify that because yeah, you need to, as someone who I know has a real affinity for a story well told, like you need to see this show because it's like I said, it's unlike anything I've ever seen before.
All right. Well, I can't wait. Whenever it happens, I can't wait for it. Alan, thank you as always, my friend. Appreciate it. And we'll catch up with you again. Well, will we talk with you Wednesday or will you be performing?
Oh, yeah. My call's not till 6:30. So
okay.
we can make some time.
All right.
We'll make Wednesday happen. For sure.
Excellent. We'll see you then. Thanks, Al.
All right. Thanks, man.
Alan Adams, The Main Edge, talking movies on Pass the Popcorn on Downtown.